I'm Christopher Lydon with the literary historian, biographer really, Kevin Birmingham. His book is about the battle for James Joyce's Ulysses, the most dangerous book, he calls it. Joyce's novel was named for the wily warrior of Greek myth. It transposed the story of the Odyssey into the buried consciousness of a single day in Dublin in 1904. And it became the fighting flag of modernism, a sort of cracked true realism filled with minute inspections of sex and the subconscious. We're talking about the story around the story, how the novel was banned in America and much of the English-speaking world into the 1930s on charges of obscenity.
When we think of what made Ulysses both shocking and revealing when it was first published as a book in 1922, one of the things we think about is that it was a book that said everything, right? Where you watch a man going to the toilet in an early chapter, where someone masturbates, where people pick their noses, where people sing and dance, where people have sex, where there's fun, where there's jokes, where there's sadness. He wanted to have everything. And these letters that Joyce is writing to Nora Barnacle in 1909, it's when Joyce went briefly back to Ireland to try to get Dubliners published, and he still didn't get it published. And Nora was back in Trieste, and they're writing letters back and forth. She burned her letters, so we only have his letters. Only his letters survive. But you can see Joyce tiptoeing into these, you know, deeper, more sordid waters with Nora Barnacle, and Nora is reading the letters carefully. She's listening. She's a willing participant, and she writes back letters in kind. And it's encouraging him more and more. And as these letters become more and more pornographic, we're also seeing Joyce saying everything for the first time, right? This is Joyce as a young writer. You know, he hasn't really published a novel yet at all. He's wondering if he should be writing at all. Dubliners still isn't in print. And he's doubting himself. But there's this power that he rediscovers not by writing fiction, but by writing to one person, to Nora Barnacle, and he's saying everything he ever wanted to say. And
well, it's almost like on a dare. I'm going to say these words. I'm going to describe our copulations.
Yeah. See what happens.
See if I can stand it. See if she can stand it. But let me just say, I'm not impressed with him as a pornographer. I mean, he can't hold a candle to Nabokov. And not that I don't mean pornography, but in terms of writing lyrically about sex, he's childish. I could do better than that.
I think he didn't want to write lyrically about it. I think possibly in portions of Ulysses he does, but I think in the letters he actually is flirting with the possibility that she'll reject him for it. And he's risking that rejection, that there was this strange element to Joyce's personality where he kept trying to push people away a little bit to see if they would come back to him. And by pushing the boundaries of decency with Nora, he was trying to see if she would stay with him no matter what, if she would stay with him after knowing exactly who he is, after he bears everything in his soul, in his heart, or whatever he's thinking. And she does. And that's how he knew he had a life partner, is because he's expressing himself and she never says no and she never rejects him for that. And so it's not really about the arousal of these letters, I think, that matters so much as the experimentation with the deepest parts of himself.
Well said. He refers to this book later, you quoted several times, to Ulysses as an epic of the human body. He is trying to say something about our carnal spirits and the mystery of flesh, and he's trying to say it all. But there's something beyond prurience there, and in a way it is what the book comes to be tested for. What is the meaning in context of this fixation on body parts, on genitals, on what happens?
Well, I think, first, I think he just thought it was the way people really were. And, there are really three episodes of Ulysses that were the most shocking and obscene to readers. Two out of those three were obscene partly because they were featuring women, and women were the people who were acting indecently. And that was particularly disturbing to people because the idea of a woman who is sexually expressive and will do what she wants and takes pleasure in sexuality was dangerous, for lack of a better word. It was a force that seemed to be able to break families apart. If women were indulging in sexual fantasies, they would go off and not be faithful to their husbands. And in fact, Molly Bloom is not faithful to her husband. So we have, in fact, the picture of what a family should not be in Ulysses. And part of what made it problematic, Molly Bloom is Leopold Bloom's wife, and we know that she's having an affair with Blazes Boylan, and Blazes Boylan actually comes over to their flat that day, June 16th, and they have sex, and she leaves. We're supposed to get the story of a woman who gets punished for this, right? That's how fiction normally works, that if a woman transgresses, she gets punished.
Anna Karenina.
Exactly. And Molly Bloom doesn't get punished for it. In fact, Leopold Bloom is aware that this affair is taking place. And not only does he not seek revenge for it or try to get angry over it, there's an implicit way that he condones it. And the fact that it's clear they still have a loving relationship, despite what's going on between them sexually, that was not acceptable. That was basically a formula for breaking families apart. The other obscene element or the other moment that got Ulysses in trouble before was actually completed as a book. This was in 1921 in New York. Ulysses was being serialized in a little magazine called The Little Review. The Gertie McDowell episode, this is a young woman. She's sort of sitting on the beach and Leopold Bloom is off in the distance watching her, and she knows that she's being watched and there are fireworks going off, and she leans back to look at the fireworks. And as she's leaning back, she is showing her undergarments to Leopold Bloom. And it was scandalous to have a young woman knowingly seducing an older man. What no one realized during the trial, and this is something that I sort of uncovered by piecing everything together and looking at all of the accounts of the trial and newspapers and so forth, is the most obscene part of it, which is that Leopold Bloom, while he's looking at Gertie McDowell, is masturbating. Mm. No one knew that because it was a little bit too obscure. So Joyce is in Paris.
It was sort of erased from some of the early editions too, no?
Yeah, so Ezra Pound was affiliated, the foreign editor of the Little Review, and he crossed out a couple of words. So there's this one phrase where Leopold Bloom recomposed his wet shirt. So he took his blue pen out and he crossed out wet, so it was just shirt. And so there were a couple of excisions that made it a little bit difficult to understand. But then Joyce realized what was happening, and so he added another key. He added several key phrases. One of them was referring to Leopold Bloom, his hands and face were working, and that's the sort of key that what's happening here. But it was, the funny thing is that it was still banned, even though people didn't know the most obscene thing happening in that book. So just to give you a sense of how stringent the laws were at the time, to have a young woman showing her undergarments, that was enough.
What does it tell you, Kevin Birmingham, that Joyce's best friends in this fight were women, including his publishers, his financial backers, yeah. Sylvia Beach in Paris? They knew something.
And it was partly, a lot of them were themselves sort of castigated for not adhering to sexual norms and standards. Margaret Anderson and Jane Heap were lovers, and they were openly homosexual. And in fact, Margaret Anderson is one of the first people to defend gay rights in print in a magazine in the United States. So I think a lot of the women were sympathetic to Ulysses because they felt as if they were day to day a part of the same sexual tyranny. The irony of it is that the obscenity laws in the United States were primarily designed to protect women. Ulysses was being,
they said, yeah.
Right. Women and, young people, children, teenagers, and so forth. But Ulysses wouldn't exist without women. It was funded by one woman. It was inspired by another woman. It was serialized by two other women. It was published by Sylvia Beach, another woman. It was published in the UK by another woman. And So Ulysses, the reason why we have Ulysses is because there are all of these people surrounding Joyce. You know, I think of The Most Dangerous Book as a biography of a book, and it's a biography that includes a lot more than just the author of that book. In order to publish a book like Ulysses, it took a constellation of people, and it's a wide cast of characters, people like Ezra Pound or John Quinn, this Wall Street lawyer, effectively, who was funding the Little Review, who was Joyce's lawyer. But then you get ACLU lawyers.
But at the core, let me just say, it took Joyce absolutely steely in his determination to stick with what he was doing.
Right.
I mean, I would think, in 1,000 writers, 999 would say, you don't like, all right, I can tone it down.
Yeah, he was stubborn.
But he was determined on a point. What was the point?
That the artist is sovereign, the same way that an individual is sovereign. Mm. To be an artist for him was actually a model of individuality. And this was part of the larger struggle that Joyce and a lot of the people of his generation, a lot of the modernists, were engaged in. It was a fight against the collective forces, which at the time were the forces that were creating World War I. It was the forces of the church for Joyce, collectivist forces that were taking away freedoms. And to be an artist, to not bend or compromise on your own imaginative vision, was to be an individual and to stand up to those things. And it was a tough thing to do, but it was sort of who he was.
I'm Christopher Lydon. You can hear more conversations on arts, ideas, and politics at radioopensource.org.